Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves, you're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing, or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry with Bahamas and USA.
Showtime!
We're gonna go nuts in there!
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 461 for the week of May 29th, 2023. I am honorary Turbo Team member David T. Cole, and I'm here with Nude Egg Sarah D. Bunting.
What the hell?
Rat Mom Tara Ariano.
They're just in my drawer.
And Money Bones Will Hines.
Their bones are their money, that's why I said it.
With us today, he is an actor, writer, and podcast host. He's been with us many times. It's Will Hines. Welcome back, Will.
Will.
Hello. Thanks for having me, guys. Thanks for having me back.
We are thrilled to have you to discuss I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robbins in season 3.
Yes.
An unsuccessful mime, the inventor of a specific dog door, a dating show contestant who's there for the wrong reasons, but not the wrong reasons you think. Tim Robinson plays all these characters, plus the weirdest guys in several different offices in season 3 of I Think You Should Leave. It dropped on Tuesday. Let's do the Chen check-in. Will, should our listeners watch season 3 of I Think You Should Leave, plus the first two seasons as well?
Yeah, 100% yes. 100% yes. Hugely great show.
Sarah.
Yes, for me as well.
Dave.
Yes.
Me too, and we may have already watched season 3 twice. As we record this, and
you may have,
we did. This will not be the last time either. So let's get into it. Will, the 2-year wait between seasons of this show can feel oppressively long, but then a new season drops, and we're all reminded if that's how long it takes, that's how long it takes. Do you feel the same way?
I kind of prefer it that way because you know what happens is they drop, and then I binge them. And then I'm temporarily overwhelmed with Tim Robinson and my mind is altered for some time and I need the 2 years to reset. Like I walk around for 2 days just feeling crazy because I'm seeing the world through the lens of the show. But it's such a special and great show that, yeah, I'd rather them take longer and have it stay good than grind out like 20 episodes twice a year and have it be diluted. Because part of the fun is like how short the episodes are, how short the sketches are, the abrupt endings.
Yeah.
And so weirdly, the 2-year wait is kind of part of that strange all killer, no filler rhythm that it has.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It kind of fits.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, you agreed. Speak on that.
It's weird how that space between the seasons does sort of reflect the form and function of the way this show works, which like this kind of show generally is like, it's not for me, but I don't tend to seek it out compared to other folks on the panel. With that said, I'm surprised all over again every time by the rhythms of it and its sort of chosen rhythms and that it knows what we're expecting from a sketch show in terms of like, here's the premise and here's where we're going to end up. Nope, we're like 52 degrees over this way or now we're just ending like the ponytail sketch, which was just like, I mean, that was the perfect place to end, but you're just not expecting it because you have Saturday Night Live in your bone marrow and in your like chromosomes and you're like, oh, this is going to drag on for a while. Oh, here's an interstitial music. Yay. Like, I think that sense of timing that it is so strong on and so confident on is what I really like about the show. Like, I enjoy watching it, but also I admire it. Mm-hmm. That it's like, I wouldn't have thought to end that there, but its ability to fuck with you while you're also laughing hysterically is just really smart. And it has this obvious depth of field knowledge about the culture's understanding of how these things work. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a reaction to the pitfalls of Saturday Night Live, which is it goes on for 90 minutes. there's too much in there, and they never know how to end a sketch. It's like all those things perfectly corrected. It can be 11 or 13 minutes. Skits just end on a dime like that, and the endings always work. And you're like, what the fuck just happened? That was super weird and funny at the same time. And so if part of that is, okay, all that, but not weekly, it is biannually, so be it.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, I think it's the funniest thing on TV for a while. Laughs per minute, your LPMs is very high, so perfectly fine. And I think, like, for a show like this that has a relatively leisurely schedule, probably means that all the principals involved can keep it going longer, you know, as they start doing movie projects and they start doing other things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not something that is taking up all of their energy all the time. Like, I feel like they can do a season, take a year off, do whatever, come back to it. So I feel like we might get more episodes thanks to this format.
God, I hope that's true. I mean, you just never know with Netflix what they're going to do. You know, something that can seem super duper buzzy to us because it speaks directly to people that have the same sensibilities as us.
Netflix is like the high priest that whisper into the Pharaoh's ear. You just like, you never know what their agenda is. They're just like, the algorithm says kill this show. And the Pharaoh's like, well, I'm sorry. We're going to have to throw you off the top of the pyramid. And it's like, you're done. So yes, you're correct. But wishful thinking, I think like that's a good strategy.
Well, I already alluded to this in my intro. The many sketches that take place in offices and are never the same or go where expected, as Sarah said. The I thought it was a volcano sketch feels like it grew out of a conversation that someone who writes on the show had with someone very boring in their life. Was that your impression of that one as well?
That's the one where it's like, I wish I could be in your mind.
Yes, yes.
After he just keeps saying like, oh, this thing looks like a this.
I thought it was a knife. Like a this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's first of all, did Tim Robinson have a day job? Like 40% of the sketches are a guy in a cubicle is weird.
Yeah.
And it seems to be going up. There are more cubicle sketches. Like as he gets more successful as a entertainment personality, he seems more drawn to the menial day job as a setting. So is Tim Robinson temping somewhere? Is he hiring writers out of corporate offices? But yeah, it seems like, you know, the initial idea, oh, what if the guy who said, oh, I thought that sound was this, what if we played with that for a while? Mm-hmm. The initial idea definitely seems like it would grow out of a conversation. But like so many sketches on the show, it goes, the specifics and the details are so surreal. And then the heightening leaps are so big. And then out of nowhere, everything's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like the first 30% of a lot of these sketches are very garden variety sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And then the last 70% is like a weird fever dream.
Could we break down one of them? Because I'm interested to see what you think of it. And it's not my favorite skit of this season. It's up at the top. But there is a skit where it starts off, again, in a conference room in somebody's business. And Tim Robinson says, you guys, if you ever, ever, ever can't drive, you give me a call, I'll come pick you up, no questions asked. Somebody in the office recently got a DWI.
DWI, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sets it up. One of the guys is at a club. He thinks back, right, calls him. He gets picked up by Tim. And then they're driving in the car, and Tim's making these, like, guppy fish faces to the camera and wiggling his fingers next to his face. And he does it for a while, and the guy in the car is sort of like looking at him strangely, and it happens again. And then suddenly, bam, we realize that Tim in this skit has a business idea where he's the driving crooner, and he has a fedora and a cigar sticker pasted on the side of his car window. And he does this little thing where he's smoking a cigar with his fish mouth, and he's doing the hand thing with the hat. And he gets very, very upset when cars don't match his speed next to him. So, first of all, we start with DWI, and then we move into the stupid idea this guy had. But also in his world, people are dissing him by not driving the same speed, because when you're not driving the same speed, the sticker in his mouth and his hand movements don't match up. Fucking weird. And then we add to that, there is this gang of teenagers driving around that want to kill him for it. And then there's like this American Graffiti type meeting at a red lighted intersection where all this stuff goes down. It is fucking mad. And me just describing it to you might sound like it might feel a little fever dreamish, but just watching it and like seeing all those beats play out, it really reminded me, Will, of going to see some of your shows at Upright Citizens Brigade, where it just like it got so fucking crazy because, you know, you're in the second half of the show, everybody's getting a little loopy, the crowd's into it, and like you just witness something where you're like, I don't know how A to Z happened, but I'm so here for it. And I'm so happy I experienced it. And I couldn't approach comedy that way. Like for so many people, it's like setup joke, setup joke, setup joke. But it seems like a full universe from the forehead of Zeus is created. There's a show Bible for everything that's going on in some of these skits that you never learn about, like what is actually happening. Because it seems like so crazy and out there, but Tim Robinson plausible, if I can just like make up a phrase and just hang that there.
I agree. It feels like you're talking about how it feels like an improvised show, the level of craziness. It feels like it captures the weird logic of jokes you have with your friends, mm-hmm. like a dumb inside joke that you and your friend develop, and then you can't even remember right. the birth
yeah.
of it.
Yeah.
A friend of mine is sober, doesn't drink, and whenever he leaves any kind of social gathering, the next time I see him, I'll be like, I told everybody you left to go drinking. Right? And then he goes, well, I'll, and then very, he'll take it seriously and be like, well, I didn't go drinking. I'm like, well, everybody thinks you did. And he's like, well, I'm going to deny it. And then I say, well, I warned them that you would deny it. But then we started doing it for non-drinking things. We went to a yoga class together. When he left the yoga class early, I was like, I told the yoga class you quit yoga. And then it devolved into just him saying out of nowhere, it'd be like, do you want a bagel? He'll be like, I don't want a bagel. And if you, and then I'll be like, I told people you're going to say that. And I warned them you would deny it. And now it's just, now I'll just say to him, I warned them you will deny it out of nowhere. And we had to sit down and be like, wait, where did that come from? Why do we tell each other, I warned them you would deny it? And so these sketches feel like those kind of elaborations, yep. like, what if a guy picks you up for to take you home because you drank too much, but he's wants to be a Frank Sinatra impersonator,
yeah.
and there right. are teenagers who are after him.
Yeah.
Which, the angry frat boys come up in more than one sketch, too. Not the same ones, just the idea of being set upon by frat boys fucking up his shit.
I always love, so it's funny how particular Tim Robinson, how unique the show is, but also how repetitive it is. Like, there is such a template of a Tim Robinson sketch, and it's like, Tim Robinson is annoying in a normal situation, and then the sketch has to make a decision. Is that person correct in
right.
his delusion,
right.
or is he alone?
Right.
Because a lot of times, the last 20% of the sketches, he was right all along, and now it's going to come true. All of his weird fears and insecurities were 100% on the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it often involves him being bullied and yelled at by somebody, often yeah. frat boys. Yes. I love it.
Oh my God.
But there's also a good balance of like, in that I'm going to kill you driving crooner, and then like smash cut away and you're like, what the fuck? But the guy that he picked up to drive home is having what I would consider appropriate reactions to having been unwittingly picked up by the fucking driving crooner, who was also in like a like fight with these toughs.
Mm-hmm.
So it is grounded in some reality. Like the ponytail sketch is like totally out there, but then she's like, he's like, oh no, there's a picture of how long my ponytail is. And she's like, this is all screenshots of cigars. Like, we all know that guy. And it's like trying to find the picture that he's talking about, and it takes 10 minutes. And it's like, okay, this is from our universe. This is from our timeline, but I would really love to know how many times Tim Robinson has seen the cinematic works of Savage Steve Holland, because there is so much like Better Off Dead, Bizarro,
oh,
I Want My $2, My Brother Who Looks Like Alfred E. Newman Is Building a Bomb in His Bedroom shit, and all of these sketches that is like, mm-hmm. is this your historical documents? Because and I love that movie and have seen it a million times. There are issues with that output, obviously, because, you know, 80s. Mm. But there is a spirit of just like nihilist fucketry
yes.
that I think pertains to both. But like when you see a pig in a Nixon mask, it's just like, what the fuck is happening? But then his rationale for that is that they're in a fight because the guy's tramp was too close to the property line. And they cut to a quick insert of that. And it's like, okay, here's reality as we occupy it. And then there's a pig in a Nixon mask. And the tying of the surreal and sort of basing it in something that you recognize is key, I think, to the success of it, because it makes the outlandish outre stuff even funnier when you see all these things that you also recognize as our reality in our shared universe. Mm-hmm. So
the things he chooses to explain with logic and the things he just lets go seems hilariously random to me. It's like, okay, there's a pig in a Nixon mask. And that's because it's an older neighbor who's mad at him and thinks he's behaving like Nixon in the way he got mad about the property line. He's a liar like Nixon. There's almost just like the thinnest possible explanation of why this guy's sick to pig with a Nixon mask on it. But we never hear about the guy's screenshot of his cigars. That's not explained.
No.
He just has a million screenshots of cigars and that's sort of let go.
But the one like that where it's like there is elements of a real issue, but then it doesn't make sense in the universe and it's better for it. There's one, doesn't have Tim, it has Sam Richardson in it as for an ad for Pacific Proposal Park.
Oh, yeah.
And it is a garden-esque area where you can go in and propose to your true love.
Like that alone is a funny idea for a sketch. That somebody has a commercial idea of a place to propose. That's almost enough. And it's not even the main part of the sketch.
Nope. And then like the additive to that is because everybody's going to be kneeling and proposing, he's made the ground nice and gushy and soft. But by doing so, like going to a picnic and attracting ants, the soft ground has attracted pro wrestlers who interrupt everybody proposing, slam chairs on their backs, pile drivers and whatnot. But all of this is in the commercial that this is presented as.
Yes.
And which also includes doxing the wrestlers in hopes that somebody will go to their house and kill them because he wishes them dead. And of course, all the wrestlers have stupid names and stuff. But it like it doesn't outlast its welcome. It's the premise. It's stupid. Some wrestlers, he's mad, and it's done. And you're just like, oh, what a perfectly timed little piece of comedy.
What are their names? Like baby...
Truck, toilet truck.
Yeah, toilet truck and baby dove, I think. And toilet truck's move is to pin you on you're on your stomach, he's on your back with his knees in your back, and he puts a toilet seat around your neck, and he goes, vroom, vroom, I'm a
like
truck.
A steering wheel.
No,
you're
a truck, you're a truck.
Oh my God. It's so perfect.
That's his wrestling move.
Yeah.
There's so many of these things that make both no sense and sort of are grand unifying theories of the universe at the same time, like when he's about to, when he's getting kicked off Summer Lovers, and he's like, I don't think I should go before I inform you that Carmelo said you're face looks like a clock, and it's like, what? But
like
also, ooh, like, isn't that something that you, as the Summer Lover picker, would go back to your fake room on the set and be like, what does that mean? You'd be like, on your Insta, like, is this the face of a clock? Like, it's so bizarre.
Is that, and also, is that bad?
Right.
Like, it just opens up all these vistas where you're like, what does that mean?
Yeah, I wanted to bring this back to something that Will and I were discussing on text earlier, which is Tim Robinson's clearly, he's in most of the sketches, not all. He's clearly not concerned with vanity. He will play the dumbest, weirdest, grossest character in a sketch. So I especially appreciate it when he plays the straight man. And maybe my favorite of the season is the very last sketch with Connor O'Malley as a volunteer on a political campaign who gets hold of his phone. And he, like, Tim Robinson, like, gets nothing really funny to do in that sketch at all and just, like, turns it over to Connor O'Malley to be the insane person that he is. So talk about that and what you feel when Tim sort of takes a backseat to the other crazies.
Well, it's a testament to how nuts Connor O'Malley is that Tim Robbins is like, I'll be the number two guy to your crazy. Right. And it's a good move. But that sketch in particular is one of the ones where it's like the logical like extrapolations from the beginning setup. I feel like the sketch starts on a cliff and then you put a plank on a cliff and you walk to the end of the plank and you're dangling over this precipice of no logic. And then you put a plank on the end of that plank and go to the end of that one until you're just way out over this canyon of insanity, because I got to summarize it, if I may.
Please.
I think I can do it quickly. Mm-hmm. Connor O'Malley is... Tim Robinson passes around his phone for people to put lunch orders in. Connor O'Malley is mad that Tim Robinson doesn't follow him on Instagram, then starts bragging about his Instagram account, which is called Tasty Time Vids. Funny vids every Friday. He promises, clearly hasn't started yet. His first vid is a video of Connor O'Malley waking up in bed with a woman, and then the reveal that this is Frankenstein's chick. That's the video, which he forces Tim Robinson to watch, bullies him over Instagram message. This is already so deep. Then there's the comments on the video are mad at him because it's come out that he paid the woman in fast food.
Right.
So there is a community of people watching Tasty Time Vids who are mad at Connor O'Malley for not properly compensating the Frankenstein chick.
Yes.
Connor O'Malley blames Tim Robinson for getting him involved in this mess because he said a half nice thing. Then the manager of Frankenstein chick takes over the account and does another Frankenstein chick sketch. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm watching this. It's like within 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, how did this... Am I the only one who's following this? Like, this is so complicated.
And then the ending of that, and don't spoil it, but the ending of that was so fucking insane. It was like the ending of the season two. I was just like, oh, that was just perfect. That was just, yeah. It made my, like, my, the wheel in my head just kept on spinning for a while, and I couldn't, like, calm down after that because it was just so kinetic. Amazing.
But like Tara's saying, like, it ends, the whole time Tim Robinson just has a confused look on his face, like, what's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. After we've watched a whole season of him being the insane person.
Yeah. Yes. It was a good capper.
What a, and that's the ending of, yeah, that's the ending of the season. He's not even really the star of that sketch.
No, not at all.
Can we just go around as a final thing and favorite sketch of the season? Just one to look out for, not to explain it, but just.
Yes.
One. All right, I'll go first.
Okay.
My favorite one, all time, what the fuck, is the free eggs sketch.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tara.
The one with where Tim Heidecker is the doctor. It's the faux drug ad where he's he wants to go clubbing with him.
The heart monitor.
The heart monitor, yes. Not drugs, thank you.
The egg had a bush and a butthole. Like, I just could not even believe that this was my life. This was my working life. Was prep.
Yes.
This, mm-hmm. in which a, like, obviously Mac classic game egg had a butthole. Respect.
Will.
Shirt Brothers.
Shirt Brothers.
The Shirt Brothers sketch.
Oh my
was
God, the end of that one.
Another one where he's favorite. The straight man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to say one more thing about the show. Look, I'm going to pull a Hollywood card, but it's so pathetic and small that I don't mind doing it. But everybody involved in this show, when I see them, this is one of those, you know, how you hear about like little comedy oases, mm-hmm. things like the Godspell production in Canada in the early 70s that like all these cast members of Second City and SNL came out of.
Mm-hmm.
And then like maybe like the Conan O'Brien writer's room of the early 90s where all the, you know, whatever, like these little collections of talent or, you know, the Dana Carvey sketch show, I think was another one that had like Steve Carell and whatever, all these folks on it. This is one because everybody involved, like the egg video game that you said was designed, I found out on Twitter today, was designed by this guy, Alec Robbins, who writes for Rick and Morty. But Alec Robbins does a comics on Twitter that are so deranged. He has a webcomic called Mr. Boop about a guy who is in love with Betty Boop and marries her. And a whole narrative weird thing about a guy who just, he and Betty Boop are in love. And he's a genius. And he's a strange, behind-the-scenes, not-famous comedic genius. And he is the guy who, he was like, I made the egg video game for I Think You Should Leave. He goes, it's a working video game. Come over to my house and you can play it.
God. Why are you still here? Go.
I mean, he said that publicly on Twitter to everybody. And then the casting director of this show, I met her at a party and she said, oh, we're at this party. She's like, oh, I got to go. My band's about to play. And it was an electronic noise band where she had two keyboards and a saxophone. And I was like, that's the casting director of I Think You Should Leave. Like, everybody who touches that show is a mad genius. So I think, although Tim Robinson certainly is the creative force, it's also one of those shows where I bet everybody who touches it is going to be, like, doing stuff for a while.
All right, it's time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara. What do you got, Tara?
Hello. I watched all of Platonic in this new Apple TV Plus show in which Will and Sylvia, who are played by Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, were totally platonic friends in college and afterward. And then Will got engaged to Audrey. Sylvia told Will he shouldn't marry her, and the friendship ended. And 10 years later, Sylvia sees on Instagram Audrey and Will are getting divorced, so she decides to reach out and apologize. And though their initial reunion kind of goes off the rails, they do rekindle their friendship, but not everyone around them is entirely supportive of Sylvia and Will spending so much time together, particularly acting like they're back in college again, even though they're in their 40s, since Sylvia has a husband and 3 children and vague ideas of returning to her old job as a lawyer after more than a decade out of the workforce. The show is co-created by Francesca Del Banco and Nicholas Stoller, who are married to each other. He is known to people who follow the Judd Apatow Factory, another comedy pod, as a writer on Undeclared. He also directed Forgetting Sarah Marshall and Get Him to the Greek, among many others. This reunites people from many different phases of his career, not only his wife, although he did write and direct the 5-year engagement loosely based on their story, but also Carla Gallo from Undeclared as a supporting role here. He directed Rogan and Byrne in the Neighbors movies. And Luke McFarlane, who plays Sylvia's husband Charlie, was in Bros last year, which Stoller directed as well. And I think part of what gives the show its very low-key kind of hangout vibe is so many of the people in it have been in each other's lives for a decade or more. Past and future guest Allison Herman reviewed the show for Variety. She wrote that it has a lack of perspective on its characters' high-class problems. I see what she's saying, but I also think it's about people in a specific class and stage of life in a specific part of Los Angeles. For example, Sylvia and Charlie wanting to buy a bigger house because 5 people are sharing 1 bathroom in the house they currently have is not portrayed like it's a crisis. It's just what is going on in their life right now. But if you're annoyed by stories about wealthy people where the wealth is just assumed and not really a plot point, I guess the show will probably bug you. But I was really charmed by it. I think Rogan and Byrne are great together. I bought them as friends. I especially bought them as the kind of friends who egg each other on to make bad decisions because neither of them wants to back down. And much as I said about Drea and Primo last week, the female lead here is not a killjoy either. Sylvia is as big a fuck up as Will. We see it pretty early on. She goes to a work retreat with Charlie and gets too day drunk to think about things she may do around people he works with every day that he may then hear about forever. Ultimately, I laughed a lot. If you like Byrne and Rogan and Neighbors and you miss character-driven feature film comedies where not much actually happens, this may take you back there. And if you do, you should also go to the theater and see You Hurt My Feelings, the new Nicole Hollis Center movie, which I saw last weekend. And
I was just going to say, sounds very similar, including the possible objections to the scene. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I will hold my plug for later, but I will link to Allison's review in the show notes.
Mr. Will Hines, what have you been watching on TV recently?
Okay, I've been watching The Night Agent on Netflix. It is a really totally just okay show that for some reason grabs me. I mean, certain shows, if they're too good, they're hard to watch. Mm-hmm. And if they're too bad, they're boring. But if they're just the right amount of goodness, they just fit. They fit your brain when your brain is nice and small. And it just snugs into your little tiny tired brain.
Somebody at Netflix just made finger guns at you because they're like, that's our brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they did it. They nailed it, The Night Agent. I don't know if I can recommend it. I when I watch it, I feel like a fed-up dad. I don't have kids, but what I mean is like a dad is just like, what's with all this crazy, complicated Marvel movie stuff? Just give me a good guy and a bad guy. I don't go for all these laser beams and whatever. It's like Night
laser
Agent,
beams and whatever.
This is going to sound like a bad thing, but I mean it in a good way. Night Agent is like dumb Bosch in that it's like tough guy being tough on behalf of goodness, but the plot is not even as smart or as human as Bosch. This is made for dads to watch when they're trying to escape from their families. That's what I think. And the basic premise is... there is a guy who works the night shift in a secret office in the White House with a phone that is specially set up for covert agents in the field to call when there's a problem, and it never rings. So if you are assigned to man the phone, that is a punishment job. You are like the night agent. That means you're a piece of crap. But he gets a phone call from somebody who's in trouble, who has all the code words, and that sets him on a 10-episode investigation of what's gone wrong with this woman who calls. He falls in love with her. They don't know who to trust. The ally one episode is a betrayer the next. It goes right to the top. The conspiracy goes everywhere. But our man, whose name I do not remember.
The Night Agent.
Yeah.
N-ite agent, yes.
Yeah, is always good, always decent, always capable, hilariously good, hilariously incorruptible.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt surrounded by a blanket of order and guns. By, you know, good guy guns, like video game guns, not like scary, sad guns. And I don't know. I don't know if I recommend it, but it grabbed me.
It sounds like it is of the ilk of a TV series version of those Helmsworth movies that are just like, okay,
yes,
you're
exactly.
a big movie star and you made this movie and it is perfectly cromulent B minus B.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
It is a B minus show, but it's a, but it's an efficient, you know, the show that knows what it wants to be and does it well and gets out is sort of pleasant in a way. So
Jack Ryan has been that for us in the past.
It is like Jack Ryan. Yes.
B plus.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Right there with you.
Love it.
Maybe B. B plus might be a little, I don't know.
No, really? Okay.
Yes. Yes.
And Will, you are all over the podcasting world. What can you direct people to get more of you?
I'll tell you this, it's a paywall thing for, so I appear on the improvised podcast Comedy Bang Bang, which has a particular fan base. You either love it or you've never heard of it, in my experience. But if you have heard of it, I'll recommend they have a paywall, CBB World, and I'm doing a show for CBB World where I teach improv classes to characters from the Comedy Bang Bang universe. And it's been really fun. I am actually an improv teacher. It's how I make steady money when I don't get acting work, which is usually. And so I've been running these real improv exercises with comedians doing their Comedy Bang Bang characters. And it's really tickling me. So it's called Heinz, I'm Prov to Meet You. And it's on cbbworld.com.
Wow.
That's my plug.
That's good SEO, man.
That's so good. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I was like, what's the worst title I could have?
All right, Sarah, what do you have?
Not that I wasn't going to watch Primo based solely on a recommendation from T-Bone, but once our esteemed colleague and past and future guest, John Ramos, was like, this is 100% Bunsy shit, and it writes adult siblings properly, I punted up the list, and it is a delight. I am delighted. I love it. To open with that rando, how tall does a guy have to be before you think he's dumb? Conversation is so brilliant.
Uh-huh.
It's so confident. The whole runner with the business apples, Drea arbitraging a guy's foot fungus into a prep school blazer. Like, the show is not perfect. There are a few actors who are still finding their way, let's say, but I don't mind that. It makes it feel more lived in, which is one of the things I really liked about it. The teenagers actually look like teenagers, not short 26-year-olds who all talk like Carl Reiner. Not that there's anything wrong with short 26-year-olds who talk like Carl Reiner. I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, wish I knew more people like that. But anyway, part of Primo's charm, I think, is the shagginess and that it sort of reflects the function of the show via the form in that way. There's a good amount of slapstick, but not too much. There's a little surreality, not too much. Occasionally, there's an aww moment, but much like the unfixed hole in the deck that isn't quite deep enough for anyone to get hurt falling into, the writing does not get stuck in those sweet moments that sound too treacly. It just keeps moving. With another reference to an intra-sibling brawl or a disastrous ingredient, it's cute. It feels like lived experience. And if you think I can't be bought with a reference in the pilot to a cloud of bees that swears all the time, you don't fucking know me at all. Primo is on Freevee. Get it into your eye holes right now.
Yeah.
And for my plug, Vanity Fair double play of sorts. A couple weeks ago, I wrote about The Secrets of Hillsong and some of the takeaways in the first couple of episodes. That docuseries has wrapped up by now, but you can find that link in our show notes. And past and future guest Mo Ryan's book, Burn It Down, is excerpted in the current issue on newsstands now that has The Weeknd on the cover. We'll have that link in the show notes as well. That book, Burn It Down, it's out next Tuesday, June 6th. I was very honored to close read it prior to publication, and I recommend it extremely highly. It is infuriating, but also heartening. And Mo Ryan will be at ATX Festival next week. She is the poo, so go take a big whiff. Tara, I believe you have a relevant plug.
Yeah, I'm going to be there too. So if you're going to be at the ATX Festival, you may see me around. I am not moderating any panels this year, unless something comes up between now and Thursday, which it may. Some of this seems to be a lot of moving parts because of the writer's strike has disrupted some of their scheduling, but I'm probably going to just be covering it for Cracked. So if you see me, come say hi.
All right, here is what's coming up on the Extra Hot Great universe of shows. This Friday on Extra, Extra Hot Great is Hot Wheels, colon, Ultimate Challenge. Yeah. We live in a fallen world and NBC is leading the way.
So many colons.
This is the one? Okay.
We'll get into it on Friday, but it's really an indicator of lots of things that are happening in the world of television.
Yeah.
Tides, ebbs, flows, changing world. Plus, in the extra credit segment, we've got Rad Men. We're doing Mad Men in different decades, how that would look. Plus, of course, Ask EHG, our new segment, 15 Seconds of Fame. And, of course, Not Quite, Winners and Losers of the Week. That is available to club members. Please go to extrahotgreat.com/club to sign up today. Support this podcast and grow that Friday show. And then right here next week on EHG Prime, it is Deadlock with Anthony Anthobuzz Farrell. If you're on again with this listener, you know Anthony, and we're going to have him on this show. We're going to have Aussie talk with our Aussie friends. It's going to be fantastic. Don't miss it.
That's noted Laura Layton archivist.
That's right.
Anthobuzz.
Now, how could I forget?
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Why, it is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon, presenting this week is Chris, and this one's been in the hopper for a while. You may send your submissions and be like, well, it's been a month. I guess they're not using it. No, 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 no. It's still there. It's still going to get used. This one's from 2021. Here we go.
Hey, Extra Hot Great Crew. I'm coming to you to present Season 2, Episode 9 of Lodge 49, La Reveille Impossible, for induction into the canon. I feel like Lodge 49 is an absolute beauty of a show, and because it was this very podcast that helped inspire me to give it a try in the first place, it only feels right that it should be represented in the canon. Lodge 49 is a difficult show to describe, but broadly, it's about people trying to build community and find moments of joy among a crumbling America that has left so many behind. Specifically, it's about Dud and Liz, two siblings who recently lost their father and are doing their best to survive in Long Beach, California. Liz, the responsible one comparatively, ends up exploring the hollowness of corporate America. Dud, who's more of a dreamer and a slacker, joins the Fraternal Order of the Lynx, a rundown Elks Lodge equivalent that may be tied into a century-old alchemy scheme, but honestly, that's not important because this is really about the characters, of which there are many great ones, primarily Ernie, a plumbing supply salesman with a gambling problem who becomes Dud's surrogate father and best friend in addition to serving as his mentor at the lodge. As Ernie described himself, I'm just a dude who hung around. In this episode, everybody has descended into Mexico in an attempt to acquire the scrolls of Lodge founder Harwood Fritz Merrill, which are being auctioned off in an old bowling bag. Like I said, this doesn't really matter. They're just a MacGuffin, or as it's said in this episode, they're worthless junk, but it's our destiny to find them. Because what makes this special is that Dud's community finally comes together, and the joy and peace he's been seeking is found. Liz has never been to the Lodge, or really hung out with any of Dud's friends from there. But they run into each other, featuring a little bit of magical realism that portray them as children in the resort's pool. The pool is important because that was the family business before Dud's father passed away, and one of his obsessions is to build it back up again. After that, and maybe the sweetest moment of the show and a great bit of acting by Wyatt Russell, who was so good in a role that could become annoying so easily, Dud finds himself totally at peace as he hangs out with Liz and Ernie and the rest of his friends poolside. Dud is a guy who has lost his dad and the family business and has been bitten by both a snake and a shark. But in this episode, he finds purpose in the quest, yes, but more importantly, he brings his family together. There are many beautiful moments between characters along the way here, and it's just so much fun as this honestly pretty crappy scheme/vacation is hatched and executed. Also, you get a great guest appearance by Paul F. Tompkins as a snooty auctioneer. This episode also really makes me long for the aftertime when we can all get together with the people we love in an overpriced hotel bar, which is both a positive and negative. Another plus in this episode, and I think that will appeal specifically to some members of the HE crew, is that the sibling relationship between Dud and Liz is one of the best on television. I know that the bad ones are sometimes pointed out occasionally when you folks are reviewing stuff. I will concede that one problem with this episode as a canon representative is that the other 19 are set in Long Beach with a few scenes in London here and there, while this takes place entirely in Mexico. By losing Long Beach, we admittedly do lose a lot, including the pawn shop that serves as the center of Dud's fraught economic existence, the donut shop that our heroes frequent, Liz's apartment where many an episode of Trashy Television is watched, which might be appealing to our panel, and the lodge building itself. But while that building has its secrets and helps drive some of the plot, as Blaze the philosopher slash apothecary says at the beginning of this episode, the lodge is where you take it. Plus, you get the mariachi version of the theme song. In addition, this episode provides us with something special to make up for the lack of Long Beach, and that is a tour de force performance from Paul Giamatti. Giamatti was a producer on the show and was featured in early episodes narrating a series of trashy books Ernie loves to listen to. But he appears in the flesh towards the end of the run, and here are some things he does in this episode alone. Shits himself, but not out of fear. Has a disgusting dumpling-eating contest with Liz. Has an orgasm so loud everyone in the resort hears it. Shoots someone because he has a pistol in his cargo chutes, says the line, "I never leave a town without a snow globe," and crashes a plane. If you induct this episode in the canon, you get all this stuff. An incredible deal. To close, I will quote past and future guests of the show, David J. Roth, writing in Defector. Lodge 49 always feels like a show unfolding in this country in this broader moment. It is sad and funny and angry about the bullshit that demeans people every day and hopeful about the capacity of those people to somehow rescue some comfort and fellowship anyway. This episode is all about the comfort and fellowship. And while in a way that's cheating, it's also so beautiful and so joyful and so representative of the best parts of the show that I think it is worthy of induction into the canon. Thank you for the consideration and for all that you do.
Thank you so much. Will, please start us off. What did you think of the episode and of the argument?
Yes, I'm a Lodge 49 fan, and I think this episode is a good choice. So I really enjoyed it, and I think it's a smart pick. It definitely is a crowded episode. This is like a really like plot heavy, a ton happens, maybe more than other episodes. But what makes it significant is it's sort of like kind of is the end of the overall quest of our main character, because the show starts where he's lost his dad and his business and his purpose. And here he finds it with his new chosen family. And if like the moment that our canon recommender described, when they're all by the pool, there's a very like a clearly framed moment of happiness before they go into sort of the third act heist. And it's kind of like, here's the real victory. He's got his friends. Almost if they pull it off or not, doesn't matter. It's very sweet. It's very moving. What I like about the show is it finds happiness not in cliche TV things. It's not love. It's not kids. It's not money per se. It's friendship. It's a sibling that you respect. It's being part of a larger community, even if that community is quite silly. You know, the lodge itself, the Order of the Lynx. It's kind of like a fantasy nerd's emotional fantasy. Like, okay, you have no purpose in your life. What if there's a secret order of Masons, but they're silly and not mean, and they're sweet and they're not racist? What if the Illuminati are quirky, I guess, is sort of like the Order of the Lynx. And it's reassuring to me. Sometimes I think that the show doesn't quite deliver the tone that the script wants. The script feels really deadpan, and I bet you it reads so special. And I think sometimes it's reaching a little bit hard. It doesn't quite pull it off in a TV setting. Stuff seems a little rushed, a little overly smiley sometimes. But I don't know. By and large, I always root for Lodge 49. I'm always on its side.
Thank you so much. I'll go next. Yeah, this, I agree. This is a very, it is packed, this episode. I feel like it's maybe, there's so much incident in it that it sort of, for me, crowds out some of what makes the show so special. And Chris touched on this. You know, it ties together not just the late capitalism aspect, but what the show does so well is portray how, like, this dying industry in Long Beach is also killing. It's generating more loneliness. Like, the lodge is the last thing sort of standing between these people and, like, complete isolation from the rest of humanity. Like that's what the quest sort of is. And Chris made this point too. But I feel like making the quest so literal in this episode, it's so much lore. Like, I feel like about this one the same way I did when we had the canon presentation back in Mark 1 for A Trip to the Dentist and Veronica Mars. Like, I know it was important in its run where it fell, but pulled out in this way, it's like it's so busy and there's so much of the world building in it that makes it too noisy to really hear sort of the sweeter, more delicate parts of Lodge 49 and what made it so special for me as a whole. I agree, Paul Giamatti is really funny this episode, and bringing him in as a full character as opposed to just a book on tape narrator, but narrating his own weird spy novels, was a great choice. And, you know, every shot of him in his cargo shorts with his dress socks pulled all the way up to his knees is gold. Of course, he only has $3 in his wallet when he loses to Liz in the dumpling contest. You know, she's great. Chris is absolutely right. Dud and Liz are always great together. And especially in this one, the moment where they snap from being children in the pool to being their adult selves is really lovely. But I feel like I got lost in the weeds of this one plot-wise, watching it isolated from the rest of its season. And as much as I appreciate a Paul F. Tompkins appearance, because he is one of the funniest people in the world, I don't know how I'm going to vote on this one. I don't know. Dave, do you want to go next and we'll have Sarah close it up?
I agree with you, Tara, that this episode does feel like it is on a different wavelength than the ones that are set. But I think it earns it because this is sort of like a resolution to a lot of the things for Dud. And the fact that it sort of happens outside of Long Beach and outside of sort of the mechanics and the rhythms there sort of like points out how hard it is. And this is the journey that gets him there. So while it is packed, I really just love this episode for its resolution. And because Dud is one of the sweetest characters ever to be on television, and you only ever want good things for him because, you know, he's just like the quintessential kind-hearted, sweet idiot. But also the episode is very funny. I don't think Lodge 49 ever gets too caught up in the lore being the show, but it does have elements that are sort of satisfying if you've been watching it forever. It's not a show. It's not a mystery box show per se. Like, mm-mm. That is the background to what it's saying about people trying to find people. But the whole auction stuff, you know, just the mechanics around that were just like a fun sort of farcical tale, which I enjoyed. So while I understand like that it feels foreign to the show because it is so different, because, you know, these are people that are kind of stuck where they are. And this is the one time in the show when they're not literally stuck where they are for the most part, that it feels kind of kinetic and maybe for all the catharsis that Dud gets, perhaps you don't get that same amount of breathing room. You don't feel it as a viewer, maybe at the way that you feel like you should. But I do enjoy this episode for what it delivered for him and his sister character. And of course, the other people at Lodge, Ernie as well. So I would probably say that I understand where you're coming from, but I actually kind of enjoy it for a lot of the things that it did in that regards. Sure.
One of my final notes on this, just trying to sort of wrap it up for myself in terms of how I was going to vote, which, spoiler, is yes, is that one of this show's enduring charms is that it's not necessary. Like, all of this is just a framework on which to hang. The hero's quest is not really about the quest. It's about the hero. That sort of closure for him is executed so well by the acting. This is a show that I've been saying all along, even when we were first talking about it. It shows middle-aged people, but isn't like stepping back from itself, all like proud of itself for that. It's just like, this is the full range of community and human beings. It's determined to show like randomness, but also radical acceptance for people's frumpy enthusiasms and frailties. Like, Paul Giamatti has an Oscar and he's pooping himself and asking someone to get toilet paper out of the van. Like, I just think that this show's heart is really big. And also, as someone with contact with the auction and antiquities community, the exhausted, oh, this is Helsinki all over again. Like, I was on the floor. Like, maybe you have to just have been sitting in virtual auctions at Heritage Auction House like I am, but it's just like, oh, yeah. This is the Dallas Liberty seated dollar incident all over again. Like, I don't, there's just something about this show that is beautiful document in how like dowdy it can be and how insane it can be. But then there are also these little moments of poetry, like when Dud is just sort of regarding everyone around the pool with their cocktails, which are being served in those glasses with the cobalt rims that literally everybody had after college in the 90s. And it just sort of made me smile for that reason. I laughed very hard at this and really enjoyed it. And thank you for the presentation.
All right, let us put this to the official vote. Mr. Will Hines, canonworthy, yay or nay?
Yay.
Tara?
I'm going to stick on nay because it doesn't matter. Thank you for the presentation, Chris.
I'm going to vote yes. Sarah?
Without writing another sextet, let's just say yes.
All right, that means Lodge 49, Season 2, Episode 9, The Vive l'Impossible. Good pronunciation, Dave. Thank you. You're here by the Target.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for winner and loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, it was kind of a thin list of options this week because of the Memorial Day holiday. So even though we were shitting on SNL in the top segment, and rightly so, our winner this week is Kenan Thompson, who got the most screen time of any cast member on SNL this year. He got almost three times that of Punky Johnson, who was in last place, because someone at TV Line actually crunched the numbers, and this is what they came up with. Wow.
Loser of the week?
I mean, I guess it's Andy Cohen because fans have seen the Real Housewives of New Jersey reunion trailer and are calling for Andy to be, quote, put on pause because he yells at Teresa Giudice in it. But I mean, the real loser, A, is Teresa Giudice, but also anybody who's sticking up for her at this point. Like, she shoved Andy into a chair. She is a weird, Trumpy, brain-injured, convicted felon shithead. That's played for laughs. Like, ha ha. Remember that time that she assaulted the host? But when he's just trying to maintain order in these reunions, it's unforgivable. And he's harassing her and belittling women. Like, Teresa does not need any help belittling herself. She's a piece of shit. Justice for Andy Cohen.
Well, speaking about pieces of shit, getting justice, you know what time it is?
Yeah, it's game time.
Welcome back to Game Time. Tara is taking this season by storm. We've had three games. She's won three games. So Sarah and Value Guests looking to get on the board today. And today we are playing Go Directly to Jail, which comes from Maddie, who earns herself an extra credit topic of her choosing and a free shirt or whatever she wants from ThroughMethods.com, home of the official EAC store.
Hey.
She writes, this game is based on the many TV-themed Monopoly board games, past and present. You will be given the names of the cheapest two properties on a particular show's Monopoly board. Name the show for 2 points at that point. Mm-hmm. If you need a hint, we will give you the most expensive two properties, after which the correct answer is worth 1 point. You can guess for free at each level.
Hey.
Steel meal situation, please, Tara Aaron.
Oh, shit. Steel meals are in play.
Sweet.
Sarah D. Bunting has 5 steel meals. Valued Guest has 1 steel meal plus Eric's meal for a total of 2 steel meals. I have 0 steel meals.
All right. So after they have exhausted their guesses, Will, before I give the correct answer, you can yell steel meal and answer to steal that person's points. But you can only do it twice in this game because you only have 2 steel meals. It makes perfect sense.
Yes.
All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first today.
We will start with Valued Guest.
All right, so Will is in pole position, then Tara, then Sarah. 30 questions, 1 growth worth equalizer challenge zone right in the middle of everything. Are we ready to play Go Directly to Jail?
Yes, sir.
All right, Will Hines, I will give you the 2 most worthless properties on a Monopoly board based on a TV show. You name the TV show.
Frank and Charlie's apartment, and abandoned pool. Those are the two cheapest slots.
Is that It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
It is. Nice. Good for 2 points. Nicely done. Most expensive is Patty Pub's basement and Patty Pub's main room.
Oh, okay.
Tara.
Yes.
Moira Rose's Garden, 4856. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's part of the clue.
Okay.
You tell me, people. And baseball field.
Moira Rose's from Schitt's Creek.
Yes. Also good for 2856. I hope that means something. I hope I just didn't read some random code that got inserted into the spreadsheet. All right, Sarah. Dorothy and Stan's apartment complex and Caribbean Vacation Hotel.
Golden Girls.
Golden Girls. Everybody's got 2 points. Back to Will. The Cleaners and Poppy's Restaurant.
Oh, I do not know. One day at a time.
The most expensive are Monk's Restaurant and Jerry's Apartment.
Oh. Seinfeld.
Seinfeld. Good for 1.
No, it's Succession.
Yeah,
it's Succession. Yeah. The other Jerry.
Tara?
Yes.
The two most inexpensive properties are Broken Elevator and Laundry Room.
Big Bang Theory.
Big Bang Theory is correct.
It's one of 2 facts I know about that show. Broken Elevator.
Well, they're also nerds.
That too. Yes, I do.
Back to Sarah.
Yeah.
LSP's Hobo Camp. LSP's Hobo Camp. And Tree Trunks Farm. Those are the 2 most inexpensive properties.
Mad Men. I don't know.
Most expensive are Finn and Jake's Treehouse and Candy Kingdom.
Why can't I pull the name of this show? Might be Adventure Time. Let's try that.
You're correct. It is Adventure Time. Back to Will. Kenny's House at Soda Sopa. Kenny's House at Soda Sopa and Hanky's House.
I know I should know, but I don't know. SpongeBob SquarePants is my guess.
Most expensive are Pee-Pee's Splash Town and Cartman Land.
Oh, South Park?
South Park. Good for 1.
Wow.
To Tara?
Yes.
Cheapest, Chucky and Lil's Wedding and Cuff.
Is this Rugrats?
Wow.
Wow.
How do you know that?
That's the only Lil I know.
Oh, okay. Back to Sarah. You've got Before the Snowfall and Blue Winter as 2 of the cheapest properties. Before the Snowfall, Blue Winter.
Blue Winter. Yellow Jackets.
Most expensive properties are The Magic of Fall and Winter Hideaway.
What?
Seinfeld again?
Bow, 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 bow. Booter boop.
Winter Hide. What was the first expensive one? I'm sorry.
All of them now for you. All 4. Before the Snowfall, Blue Winter are the cheapies. The ones that cost real money are The Magic of Fall and Winter Hideaway.
Ice-capades? I don't know. Someone steal it, please.
I don't know.
I mean, my first guess was Game of Thrones, but not Magic of Fall. And then my next one was like, is it just generally Hallmark
not a scripted
movies?
Show.
Okay. Then I don't know.
It is no longer on the air.
Uh-huh.
It was a public station.
Oh, is this Art of Painting or whatever?
The Joy
Bob
of
Rice?
Painting with Bob Ross, yes.
Oh, cute.
All right, to Will, we've got Himalayas. Seems like it shouldn't be cheap, but there you go. Himalayas.
No.
And Erta Ale. E-R-T-A-A-L-E.
I do not know. How about Doctor Strange, the TV show? Which doesn't exist.
I think there was a TV movie, and maybe Doctor Strange, I think.
Maybe. Probably.
The most expensive are Arctic and Antarctica.
Still don't know. How about Dora the Explorer?
Ooh, incorrect.
Good guess.
The answer we're looking for is Planet Earth. Planet Earth, the TV show, the game.
Has a Monopoly game? Good
sure
grief.
Does. Yep.
And Antarctica is the most expensive. Not Manhattan? Okay.
Yeah, what?
Or how about just the Galapagos Islands? I have pitches.
It's more of a, you know, like you have to build hotels in Antarctica. It's very expensive to get the materials down there to heat the place.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Every winter you got like a shining thing happening. It's just a lot of me. Okay. Tara.
Yes.
Crimson Chopper and Old School Chopper are your cheapest properties.
Airwolf.
The most expensive are Future Bike and Black Widow Bike.
Oh, no. G.I. Joe.
Incorrect. We were looking for American Chopper.
Oh, okay.
The game.
Sure.
All right.
Were we?
Back to Sarah. Yes.
Someone was.
Sarah.
Speak for yourself.
Moonbase 1 is the cheapest. Sea of Rust is the second cheapest.
Moonbase 1 and Sea of Rust. Stargate SG whatever.
All right. I have no idea how these are pronounced. Kaon City, K-A-O-N, Kaon City, and Icon City, A-I-C-O-N.
Samurai Jack.
It was a cartoon. It was Transformers.
It was more than meets the eye.
Everybody's got one question till we get to our midpoint with our challenge zone equalizer, Sitch, for Will. Dark Fortress and Diva Talks ship. Dark Fortress and Diva Talks ship.
Okay, Below Deck.
I love that guess.
Love that.
Gossies Command Center, G-O-S-E-I.
Okay.
Zordon's Command Center. Two command centers there at the top.
Okay, Battle of the Planets.
Oh!
An anime show from when I was 10.
You're close. You're in the right wheelhouse. That was Power Rangers. Tara.
Yeah.
Castle of the Two Sisters. Mm-hmm. Zecora's Hut.
I'm going to guess Game of Thrones this time. Okay.
Most expensive. Crystal Empire.
Sure.
Canterlot.
Doctor Who.
Close. My Little Pony.
That is close.
All right, Sarah, take us into our score break.
Yes.
Wheeler House, Henderson House are the two cheapest properties on the Monopoly board based on what show?
Wheeler House and Henderson House. Animal House.
The most expensive are Hawkins Lab and Creel House.
Ice Road Truckers. I just don't know.
Hawkins is where Stranger Things takes place. Stranger Things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we started off with a bang. Kind of slow down after that.
Yeah,
let's hear the scores.
Kind of.
Whimpers galore.
All right. Well, I have 6. Will has 4. Sarah has 3.
All right.
She's in the zone.
Sarah D. Bunting. Five boxes to choose from. Do you know which one you want, sight unseen, or can I read them to you?
I think Famous Original Trivial Pursuit, if that's still available.
Famous Original Purple TV Box from Trivial Pursuit. I will read you 6 questions. One. If you get all 6, my goodness, if you get all 6, I will give you 5 points. If you get 3, I will give you 2 points.
Good luck.
Okay. Here we go. Classics is your category. What writer had a fistfight with Sid Caesar over a monologue he wanted to perform on Your Show of Shows?
Lenny Bruce.
Mel Brooks. Sitcoms. What sitcom character received blood from a...
Stone.
Oh, okay. No, I just had to pause and read it because it's just not the kind of language you use anymore. Okay, here we
all
go.
Right.
I'm just going to read it because I can't go grab another.
It's from the past.
Ooh, yikes.
What sitcom character received blood from a black in a gallbladder operation? Now, I'm going to say the reading of that is also a clue to the show.
It's probably a quotation from the show, I would guess.
I don't know. Don't make me repeat the question.
Blood from a black?
Yes.
Oh, okay. With skin crawling, I will answer All in the Family.
Oh, wait, no. Sitcom character.
Oh, Archie Bunker, sorry. Yes.
Drama. What if the questions are just increasingly racist? Thank goodness they're not. Okay, drama. Who buys Jim Anderson's home on Father Knows Best, Home for Christmas? Who buys the home? If you get this, I'm just going to stop the episode right now, and we're all going to go home.
Chip Douglas.
Bud Anderson. Three questions left. Kids and Games. What's the secret identity of Empire State University grad Peter Parker?
Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Will, can you confirm? Host of Spider-Man
confirm
podcast?
That, yes.
Okay, very good. You need one of these last two. Stars. The answers are usually celebrities. Who was the unquestioned star of Saturday Night Live from 81 to 84?
The unquestioned star?
Who's the biggest star then? I don't know why they had to qualify like that. Like there isn't some guy going, I disagree.
Yeah. I've been drinking absinthe. Eddie Murphy, I'm going
to
say.
Eddie Murphy is correct. 2 points added to Sarah's total, please.
I'll take it.
Done.
Get back into the game. And speaking of adding points, we're halfway. You've all passed go. Everybody's total is increased by 200, please, Tara.
Oh. Okay.
All right. Back to Will.
Yes.
Remind you, I'm going to give you the two cheapest properties now. Tire Yard.
Good.
And Cletus's Shack.
Andy Griffith Show.
Good guess. The most expensive are Springfield Glen Country Club and Burns Manor.
Oh, Simpsons.
Simpsons, good for one. This is question 17.
It's pretty good.
It is for Tara.
Yes.
Cheapest properties are Camp Tuckahoe and Pork Chop Loading Dock.
Sure. RuPaul's Drag Race.
That is good for two. To Sarah. Two cheapest are Rodeo Arena and Market Equities.
Rodeo Arena and Market Equities, Dallas.
That's a good guess.
The most expensive are Dutton Ranch Stables and Dutton Ranch Main House.
Hmm. That shit has a Monopoly game?
Seriously? Okay.
Why wouldn't it?
Yellowstone.
Yellowstone is correct. This
It'll
is
be
for
a
Will.
One Monopoly game?
It is question 19. Your two cheapest properties are City Dump. I just like the idea that somebody's building homes and hotels on City Dump. And Fuzzy's Cabin. Fuzzy's Cabin.
I don't know. Fraggle Rock. I don't know.
Most expensive are Bonsai Gardens and Mojo Jojo's Lair.
Powerpuff Girls.
Powerpuff Girls is good for one.
Nice.
Tara.
Yes.
Cheapest. Psychologist's Office and Janitor's Closet.
Oh. Mindhunter. Whatever it was.
Most expensive. Rebecca's Office.
Sure.
And Owner's Box.
Oh, Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso, good for one. All right. Has Sarah D. Bunting been paying attention to all the guesses in this game so far? Your cheapest properties are Hard Home, Cave of the Three-Eyed Raven.
Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones
Yay!
Is finally the correct answer.
Nice,
it's good for
nice.
Two. Mm-hmm. Most expensive, in case you're wondering, Dragonstone and King's Landing. Uh-huh. Back to Will. Cheapest are Vacant Storefront and It's Your Funeral Home and Crematorium.
Police Squad.
The most expensive are Mr. Fish Odor's Estate and Wonder Wharf.
SpongeBob?
Oh, well, you got part of that right. Bob's Burgers. Sorry, I should have paused there for a sec. Somebody might
never
want to
seen
steal
it.
That. Good
You'd
show.
Like it.
Tara.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Cemetery, again.
Yep.
I don't think you should be able to allow houses and hotels on a cemetery, but here we are. Monopoly pays by different rules. Mm-hmm. And The Funeral Home.
The Addams Family.
Satriel's Park Store. and Whitecaps Shore House.
The Sopranos.
The Sopranos, correct. Sarah. Atlanta Survivors Camp and Downtown Atlanta are the cheapest properties in this game.
Atlanta?
Most expensive are the Hilltop Colony and the Alexandria Safe Zone.
As I was making the joke, I realized what it cost me. The Walking Dead.
You are correct. To Will. Yes. Cheapest two properties are Public House and Armorer's Workshop.
Right. Peter Jackson's crib.
No, but let's give him some Dave points for that one. That was funny.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, great.
A couple Sarah points, too.
Let's Most see. Expensive are Navarro Lava Field and Imperial Safe House.
I do not know what this is. The Expanse. I have no idea.
Well, it is sci-fi. We were looking for The Mandalorian.
Oh, right.
Oh, wow.
I would have said Andor. But...
Tara.
Yeah.
Sewer City.
Mm.
Cookieville Minimum Security Orphanarium.
Futurama.
That is good for two. Sarah. Santa Muerte Shrine and Clovis's Tow Yard. That's with a W. Not some guy's has lost it.
I was like
digits in his yard.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first one again? I'm sorry.
Santa Muerte Shrine.
Beverly Hillbillies.
Most expensive is You Store It. You Store It and the White House.
The White House?
Yeah. I'll give you a clue. It's not that the White House.
Oh. Okay. Oh.
Is it the House of Cards, White House? House of Cards.
Okay. All right. Steel Mill, Will?
These are all TV shows?
Yep.
Then I don't have one.
Yeah. What was your guess?
It's like a Silence of the Lambs. Like, they have that storage facility. And
I know I said it wasn't a movie, but I'm going to buzz you anyways because it makes me feel like a big man.
No, I deserve it. I deserve the shame.
Well, but it did become a show.
Kind of.
Oh, did
in
it?
A sense. Clarice?
Not
Hannibal.
By name.
Didn't we
oh,
talk
yes,
about
yes,
it?
Yes.
And
Hannibal,
Clarice.
Right.
And Clarice. Became two shows.
Yeah. The show we were looking for is Breaking Bad.
The White House.
Right.
The House of the White.
Oh, the White House.
Okay. Everybody's got one question left. This one is for Will. Cheapest properties are Boxing Gym and Horse and Hop. Boxing Gym and Horse and Hop.
The Wire.
Most expensive are Buckingham House and the Royal Palace.
Great. Downton Abbey.
Anybody?
Oh.
The Crown?
Looking for Bridgerton. Bridgerton.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
right. Will, you said The Wire so fast and so confidently, I really believed that you knew it and that was the right answer.
Also, The Wire having a Monopoly board is poetry.
Such a good actor.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Just I've been faking it my whole life.
Hear Will's cry.
Boxing Gym we all saw on The Wire. And Horse and Hop sounds like it could be a Baltimore bar.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Where the mayor hangs out? Sure. Mm-hmm.
Last one for Tara.
Yep.
Grace Fellowship Church and the McMurrays.
Oh, no. What is the church? I don't know. I'll take the next hint.
The most expensive are the barn and the farmhouse.
The Waltons?
Incorrect. We were looking for Letterkenny. Letterkenny.
Oh, sure. Wow. Nice.
All right. Last regulation question. It is for Sarah D. Bunting. You've got, as your two cheapest properties, Shankshaw State Prison and White Worm with Y's instead of I's. It's not that the White Worm.
Next clue, please.
The most expensive are Lodge Apartment and the Pembroke.
Castle Rock? No. I'm just pleased that I pulled that name.
That's good.
Is a show that existed.
Thank you, everybody, for gathering here today on Sarah D. Bunting's funeral. As we all know, we're here to solve the mystery of her last words. Riverdale.
Riverdale. Stay at her.
And that's regulation. Let's get our final scores, please.
Okay. Will has 206 points.
Nicely
Sarah
done.
Has 209 points. I have 212 points.
All right. Before All right. we go,
congratulations.
Thanks.
This last question as a tiebreaker. Shout out the answer when you know it. We'll get you something good. I will read you the two cheapest. And then after a while, if nobody gets it, I will read you the two most expensive.
Okay.
Cheapest properties. USS Swinetreck Veterinarian's Hospital.
Muppet Show.
Muppet Show from Sarah D. Bunting is the correct answer.
Oh, nice.
We're going to add a steel meal to her total.
Tara.
All right. Tara. Well, thank you very much, Maddie, for that game. Fun stuff. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We paid it forward with our look at I Think You Should Leave's third season before going around the dial with stops at Platonic, Night Agent, and Primo. We traveled south of the border down Mexico Way to induct Chris's choice of Lodge 49's The Vrible Impasible into the canon. We crowned winners. That was fun. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Maddie. Next up, it's Hot Wheels Ultimate Challenge and much more on EEHG this Friday. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
just for the record, it's Le Rêve Impossible.
Says you, Sarah D. Bunting.
Does my face look like a clock?
And Monsieur Will Hines.
We're Shirt Brothers, bro. You gotta help me.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Our summer fling is over. You should pack your things and go.
Sure.
Ah.